Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, July 15th, 2002. Today's session is titled Forum, Modern, Postmodern, A Conversation, presented by Dan Geslin, Mark Gensler, and Miriam Schmidt. The number is FO2002-30. Let's listen in.
I've been assigned by Bob Rothstein, our summer teaching coordinator, to have a discussion like this, a forum, on human sexuality every 3 weeks. So, and because the last one, which was 3 weeks ago, which was during Gay Lesbian Pride Week, turned out so well, and I thought that the places where it got most interesting were around this kind of topic. But I thought it would be fun just to try to have a conversation on modernism and postmodernism. So we've come up with, we haven't rehearsed not only that, but we haven't discussed anything in any way. We don't have any preconceived questions. We're going to start by introducing ourselves briefly, which we believe, from prior experience, will start us right off into the discussion because of different life experiences. If you're here because you have no idea what this is about, you're in the right place. And it might be that beginning to enter into the confusion is the next step to take, because more and more people are coming to understand, coming to sense that we are in the midst of a huge paradigm shift, more than an era change, but a paradigm shift that which we've only experienced in the past, say, from medieval to Renaissance, or Renaissance to modern. We have a sense in retrospect that these huge, many centuries long periods, classical, medieval, Renaissance, modern, which started about 1500, is now shifting again that dramatically. And what does that mean? And we don't know what it means. We don't even know what to call it. So philosophers who are thinking about it are just coining this term postmodern until we think of a word that's a better describer. Or perhaps this is all malarkey and there isn't anything to it at all. But just welcome you to the conversation. And since I asked Mark and Miriam to say a few words about themselves, they said I should do the same thing. So I'll just do that. And then hand over to you. And my picture, which I've gotten consensus with them, is that after just a little initial talking among ourselves, we'll open it up so that we're all talking together. And we are happy to serve as point people for that discussion if you want to ask us questions. So, I grew up in Minnesota in a Lutheran home, came of age during the Vietnam War, was very much active in the anti-war movement in college at St. Olaf College, in which I did things like help take over the administration building and had a sit-in in the president's office and try to get ROTC off campus, that kind of thing. in my mid-20s, became a high school English teacher. In my mid-20s, started wrestling with being gay. Gradually let myself identify as that. I can remember in the midst of that process, journaling and getting, which I did a lot of in those days, and getting to the end of a sentence that was going to be something like, I am gay, but I couldn't write that down in the journal. Because that would, even that was outside of myself. Gradually, and went to seminary, which seemed a very strange thing to do, I thought, and so I chose to go to seminary quickly in the late 70s, the Lutheran Seminary. During that process of living in the Bay Area, I became what the Lutheran Church at that time called a self-affirming homosexual, and was able to talk about it and not hate myself. Therefore, could not be ordained in the Lutheran Church and transferred to the United Church of Christ Seminary in Berkeley. I graduated in 1983 and was ordained. It was right at the moment when AIDS was starting. And no, that name hadn't been created yet. Some people were calling it the gay cancer. There was tremendous hysteria going on. And bus drivers were wearing masks and rubber gloves, and anyone they thought looked sick or looked gay, they would not let on the bus. Roving bands of teenagers were beating up people on the street who looked gay. The medical field was also in crisis because they didn't know what it was or how it spread. And I just happened to have friends who worked at San Francisco General Hospital. And because of the crisis there, gay people who already worked at the hospital volunteered, from doctors to nurses to janitors, volunteered to start an AIDS ward where the administration of the hospital couldn't force people to work there as a volunteer. And because I knew these people, I became the chaplain in the new AIDS ward, and did that for 5 years. Then I started the first gay and lesbian congregation in the United Church of Christ in Minneapolis, and then the third one, which was in Cleveland. That all covered 19 years, and then I came here where I'd been on teaching staff before and had come as a kid. And my partner is John. And I'll leave it at that.
Go for it.
Well, my name is Mark, and I serve the village as the librarian, and I also clean toilets. As an application, as opposed to a vocation. Briefly, I'm 31 years old, and I think that age and generation can inform often how one responds to self-definition in a variety of arenas, but particularly that of what we have come to call sexuality, what you do with yourself and with others as a sexual being, as a physical being. There are other ways of defining that. Let's see. grew up in a number of places, in mostly in the East, in Pennsylvania, Ohio, and New York. Pertinent to this topic, this is probably a moment in my teens when I recognized quite easily, not that it was easy to acknowledge, but recognize quite easily, oh my heavens, I'm quite different, at least in terms of who I desire and what that looks like compared to what I imagine other people to desire, other boys my age. And I don't think that I used the word gay. I think I very consciously, was this me? Was this a generational thing? I don't know. But I very consciously shied away from saying, I am gay. As I grew older, not because I thought that it was wrong. I had a very supportive family, actually, in exploring issues of what it means to be a person who sexually is drawn to a person of the same gender, primarily drawn to a person of the same gender. As any person in our culture has, I had and have a lot to work through with regard to that, as I think perhaps all of us do with regard to coming to an understanding of ourselves as whole people, as trying to arrive at a sexuality that is integrated, that we come to with our whole being. I'm sure that can resonate with all of you in your lives. The language, though, is an interesting thing to me. What do we mean when we use the word gay? What do and as you know, different words have been used for this sort of sexually encountering the world. Queer in the 20s, the 30s, went out of fashion. Homosexual came and went. Gay and lesbian, then adding a whole other list, gay, lesbian, transgender, bisexual, the language most prayerful for you, as we tend to say. and indeed the word queer has reappeared, but in a different sense now. Not to folks on Twitter, are you queer? meaning, are you someone who is primarily attracted to someone of the same gender, but are you queer? Meaning, do you, and maybe this is where I should let me jump in, because that's, for me, that's not a word that I particularly enjoy using for myself. It can describe, at least for me, a sensibility where sexuality is a little more politicized is a word that comes easily to mind, but it's not quite what I mean. I apologize for the rambling quality here, but that's a longer discussion. I have a very postmodern, if you will, suspicion of language. Language does not feel solid to me. So to say, I am gay, in a certain context, in a certain discussion, can make sense, because I can say, all right, the other person, they have an idea of what I mean, particularly if we're talking for an hour. But as we all know, language can be very slippery. What are you talking about when you use a given word, and perhaps especially so in the realm of sexuality, where our own experiences are so idiosyncratic, so particular to each one of us. So that makes me, in my own experience, very suspicious of language, of there being a solidity, a there, if you will, at the base of that word, with the gay, homosexual, queer. So I, as is my wont in a number of settings, just require a little more time to offer a more rounded explanation, if it's appropriate in a given discussion for a certain person, to give them a sense, if it's necessary, of who I am. That leaves aside, though, the question of the political realm. It's all well and good for me to say, all right, I need 2 hours to explain my sexuality to someone, if that be necessary. What do you do when what you're talking about is the right to keep a job or the right to make a decision whether your lifelong companion should have life support or not have life support? We need shorthand for things like that. And that's where language comes in, language we're more comfortable with. I have, as I said, a very postmodern, a suspicion of language. It does not feel solid to me, particularly in terms like this. But there are situations where I think it's necessary to just say, I'm gay, gay rights, or I'm queer. And meaning, if the point of a human sexuality for all of us is to arrive at a point where we can be who we are, whoever that may be, with a sense of integrity, meaning that we bring all of ourselves to our ways of being with other people, people we love intimately and people we just meet. I think that it does become largely a question of public language, of civil rights, as opposed to a private language, which for me is one which is far more fluid and does not necessarily involve easily identifiable terms.
I need to stop you there.
Yeah, which is where I was going to stop. I apologize for the ramble, but hopefully that generates at least some what the hell is he talking about sort of questions, and if so, when the time comes, please raise them.
I'm Miriam. I'm 25, and I serve the village as one of the food service coordinators here. Dan and I have been in this kind of ongoing discussion since last summer that has been intriguing to me, and we've kind of played around with this idea, wouldn't it be great to just get together and do a forum on like modern, postmodern discourse around sexuality? Because since last summer, when we kind of met, I came here right amidst June, right on the edge of Pride last summer here. Right on the edge, there was a lot of talk in the village after the ordination of Anita Hill, the lesbian pastor in Minnesota. There was a lot of talk about gay and lesbian ordination in the Lutheran Church. So we found ourselves in a lot of the same arenas of discussion, some forums, some sessions around sexuality and the church and gay and lesbian issues. And we found again and again that that we, I think, very much having to do with our different generations, talked about sexuality and self-definition with different language. The way that I talked and constructed my own sense of sexuality was different than the way that Dan talked about his construction of sexuality in general and for himself personally. And so we found this very interesting and we thought, oh, wasn't this great? We should talk more about this. And Mark, I've been talking with all this year about some of these issues as well in terms of construction of how does one talk about the construction of sexuality. And it's something that's just personally interesting to me. So I'm the youngest of these three, and however it plays into it, I'm also a woman, and I do think that that plays into it differently, because I then have this whole history of what it means to talk as a woman, what it means to come on the tail of the decades of feminist movements behind me, and what it means for me as a woman at 25 in 2002 to be able to have the voice to talk about herself and self-defying. So that's kind of another piece that I put into this. But I was in college in the mid-90s, which was very different than being in college in the 80s or the 70s or the 60s in terms of coming out, whatever that meant. I came out when I was probably in 1994-ish. The 90s were a time of a lot of change. Almost every year you could see a huge change in terms of the ability for people to talk about sexuality and really like kind of move the discussion about, it wasn't just like, are we gonna not beat up the gay and lesbian people on our campus? Like it was beyond that. And I went to a fairly progressive liberal arts college on the East Coast, where there were courses where I realized I was looking through this and I was like, oh, this would be kind of fun to show because not every college has these courses, but this was a course that was in the early 90s established by one of the French professors at my college called The Epistemology of the Closet, Literary and Theoretical Constructions of Male Homosexuality. This was the kind of course that you could take at my college in 1992, you know? So in 1994, to start the process of coming out, it was definitely a very acceptant place. The school was in the process of changing the name for, you know, the third or fourth time of what that gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgendered group of people on campus that were for, you know, gay rights, like whatever that group was. They were in the process of changing the name of that group from the GLBT group. You know, at first it had been the gay, you know, the gay club, and then it was the, you know, gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender club on campus. And then it was, in my time there, the queer union, for whatever that meant. So there's, and it's fascinating to me to think about the change of language through those years. And what did that mean to change the language to talk about this? And I'll try not to ramble too much, Dan. I'll finish this. But when I first came out, in a kind of a shorthand history of my own personal journey through this, I fell in love. I fell in love, and the object of my love was a woman. And I thought a lot more about being in love with a woman than I thought about my sense of sexuality at first. I thought a lot about, I was just in love, and it was with a woman. And the first thing that I said to my parents was not, "Mom, Dad, I'm a lesbian." It was, "Mom, Dad, I'm dating a woman. I'm in love with a woman." That's kind of the language I can put on this right now. A year later or so, it was important, and had I been pressed, actually, had I been pressed at that time, and I think at one point my mother did press me, "So Miriam, what are you? How do you define yourself?" And I was like, "I don't know. I had dated men before that." So I said, "Well, maybe I'm bisexual. I don't know. But that really wasn't something that I was comfortable with identifying with when I was 18. A year later or so, it became important for me to feel a part of a culture of people. It became important for me to feel a part of a larger group. And all of a sudden, I started identifying with what I felt a larger lesbian culture around me. I looked around at other women who identified as lesbian, and I said, "I feel connected with these women. I feel like there's a bond here. And I take strength from being a part of this larger community of lesbian women." And I thought about myself in high school, and I thought, gosh, Miriam, you know, when you were like 15, you went into bookstores and you went to the gay and lesbian sections of bookstores and found some sense of kinship and comfort in seeing that there were people writing about the experience of gay and lesbian people in the world. And you felt connected to that even before you had any conscious sense of identification with that.
Which was a section that did not
exist
in mainstream bookstores
in 1973. So this is very much I was able to do that in the 90s. Anyway, now I'm 25. How would I identify? I, perhaps unlike these two gentlemen here, find a lot of comfort in and find comfort in the identification with the word queer. And that's a very 1990s word. It's very much it's a word for me that encompasses so much more than and breaks some of the boundaries that I see problematic in the categories of gay and lesbian and bisexual and transgender. Not that I don't think that all of these categories and all of these categories of identification have great importance. And as Mark was talking about, politically they have importance. And there are certainly times where my identification as a lesbian still feels very important and still feels very true to myself. But the word queer for me challenges some other notions of sexuality and basically challenges a notion of normal sexuality in this society, that there is a normal sexuality and that those straight people who are married, who have some sort of certain kind of sex that you can categorize like this, those people are normal. And everyone else isn't. And basically, because they're not normal, they're abnormal, they're wrong, they're sick, they're not included. I feel like the word queer challenges that notion of normal sexuality in so many different arenas, like in a sense of gender, in saying that our gender is more complicated than just that we construct our genders as women and men, and that's a complicated thing in this day and age, that that who we have sex with and how we have that sex and what kind of sex that is a complicated thing, and that there isn't just a clear normal that is right, and that we have to complicate that, and that it is actually a healthy thing to complicate that, because the simplified notion of what is normal and right has actually boxed people in, not to health, but boxed people into kind of a repressed state of not being able to express themselves fully. So.
So, I'm gonna just say something really briefly about our historical context right now, and then we'll open it up in the because it's kind of where Miriam you brought us from the personal to the social, and one possible say social anthropological approach to what we're talking about is that the transition into the modern period, which would have happened with the printing press, but also the Industrial Revolution, some social theorists say that in order for the Industrial Revolution to work, all of these Western European people who were living family basically rural lives in which everybody was just sort of doing their own thing, and individuation was a fact of life because people were isolated. When the Industrial Revolution starts and everybody starts moving to the city, all sorts of social attitudes have to change in order to get people to be a workforce. And that this has been an important strand of what modernism is, that all of a sudden the terms like normal start becoming, in an unconscious way, start becoming really important in society. We can go further in that direction if you want to in a couple of minutes. In the mid-80s, the work of a French philosopher named Michel Foucault, who wrote mostly in the 70s, and most of us are just starting to hear his name now, because that's the way, because we just got done with figuring out Einstein, and that was a long time ago. Michel Foucault started writing about, he's kind of looked at as one of the parents of the postmodern sensibility. And he came up with this phrase, the social construction of being. Miriam talked about the construction of our sexuality. This hit the American graduate school scene in the mid-80s really strongly and caught the imagination of a whole generation of people who turned into the teachers that Miriam took classes from. And so we have a whole generation growing up, I think, with some of the sensibilities that Mark and Miriam are expressing. And last year, I did a series of sessions here at Holden about the gay and lesbian stuff. Not specifically, but because of the context vis-a-vis ordination and the ELCA. And Miriam was in one of those classes, and we were just kind of learning each other's names. And she said, why are all you people talking about this? I mean, what is the issue here? We don't, you know, in my generation, we don't eat this. What are you talking about? Why is this an issue for me? And I think that's a really important point to the church, because I am teaching these classes at Holden Village in the hope that the church will finally catch up to what was going on in the 1970s. Meanwhile, there's a whole generation that doesn't even relate to this anymore, and they're the people not going to church anymore. So here's this concept that is very postmodern, and maybe it's true and maybe isn't, but that there's a social construction of reality. There's a social construction of sexuality, of gender, even of nature. In modern terms, we talk about there's normal sexuality, and we use arguments from nature, that this is the natural way. Foucault and the social constructionists are saying, no, we have been taught to see nature in a certain way. It's not real, it's just the way we've been taught. We've been taught that, we've been taught a social construction of gender. there's one and only one way to be a girl, and one and only one way to be a boy. And for 500 years, everyone in the Western world has agreed. This is what boys are, this is what girls are. Feminism started changing all of that. And before they had this language, we're in a different ways telling us that's a social construction of what feminine is that we no longer accept. Can we go all the way to sexuality, to what Miriam was just talking about, in terms of, are there straight people? Because straight people, well, I can't answer that. Are there straight people? Is there a variety of sexuality among people who define themselves as straight, or is there just one missionary position, and that's what everyone, that defines everyone, and anyone who's not that is abnormal or sick or perverted, or is this fluidity that Mark and Miriam have been talking about more what the reality is, and that as, and then I'll come full circle and stop, and that as we move out of an economy that needs a bunch of working class people all doing the same thing, and more we're, that's being farmed out to other third world countries where they can do this, and all of a sudden we have leisure, but we also have a need to be working in different ways that allow us to work at home on computers, and we're kind of, in some ways, there's an interest, a renewed interest in what was life like in medieval times when people had cottage industries and all worked at home, and what was their individuation like, and is that a model we need to be looking at, because that's the future we're going into, and do we get out of, how do we get out of this, if we need to, heavy yoke of this is sexuality, this is good sexuality, this is bad sexuality, this is good people, bad people. What is the role of the church and religion in that? If we're changing those ethics that we had, say, in the 50s, is it everything goes, or are there new ethics forming? These are all the questions that this modern, postmodern stuff is about. So it's your turn, and if you want to use us as sounding boards, feel free to ask some questions.
I guess I'm interested in the language of modernism and postmodernism itself. And I have some problems with postmodernity. And it's great in a lot of ways in terms of its ability for deconstruction. And that continues to need to go on in so many ways. But I think where it's lacking is in the area of reconstruction. And I'm not saying that we need to reconstruct in a way that's normal, but yet, you know, if you take postmodernism to its extreme, there's no center.
Yeah.
Exactly. Everything's relative.
And it's parallel.
So yeah, I mean, I just think in sexuality or whatever, there needs to be some kind of reconstruction that remains fluid, that remains open, but a reconstruction nonetheless.
So for those of you who might be new to all this language, Paul's talking about deconstruction. So for the last 15 years, using that feminist model, you know, what the feminists were doing in this language system is deconstructing the social construction of what it means to be a woman. And saying that's just a fabrication of society, it's not reality. And we are free to deconstruct that and be whatever we want to be. But that puts us on this pioneering edge of what are we going to reconstruct?
And at times, Paul, what I hear both in language and like that, and also when I hear myself articulating that idea, all right, so if I take this apart, say that we're deconstructing this tower, forgive the image, of sexuality here, no, and we're taking it apart bit by bit by bit by bit, this fear that I feel myself that after one takes something apart, there's nothing left, that there's absolutely nothing left to meaning, to the self, to and why get up in the morning? And why, you know, as maybe some, I think it was Derrida, who was a French, of course he's French, they're all French, literary critic, you know, essentially imagining himself in a room afraid to move a finger, to just because he doesn't know what it means to do this. And Yes, that sort of paralysis is there. But what I hear in that is the fear that at the end, and for myself, at the end of all that deconstructing, first of all, that there will be an end to all of that deconstructing. That you can take it all apart down to the foundation. I think one notion would be that the foundation is just as endlessly revolving as the rest. And there, for me, at any rate, is where we leave literary theory and philosophy, if you will, and enter the realm almost of theology, where I begin to find it immensely beautiful. Because on some level, it's an article of faith for the small f, that there's a there. It's beyond language, which is what all of the postmodernists would tell us. It cannot be spoken. In fact, Foucault has written it. He says, I wish I did not have to speak. I wish I didn't have to pretend to use language as if it were a solid thing like this book. I wish that I could simply open my mouth and let the discourse speak through me. You know, on some level, that's a little disingenuous, because we all speak, and we all want to love, and, you know, we all want to think that when we use words, we know what we're meaning. And I think, on some level, for me, that's where we must, as postmodern people, if you will, who have become very good at deconstructing, at a certain point, know when to move it aside and say, yes, begin to build, and on what do you base that? And I think that that's when you begin, at least intellectually, but emotionally, to move into something more akin to theology, or ethics, if you were, as Dan was, if that makes sense.
I mean, when you said that's what the postmodernists would say in terms of no language, I mean, that's what the mystics say.
Exactly!
It's not new. It's not new. And it's kind of annoying. Like, on some level,
careers are made out of
But it's the age, it's important.
Sure.
Like, but it's the fact that, you know, how I it's a very 20th century thing. I think, like, there were all of these decades of people who were, you know, putting things down, and there were these new ideas, and it was so scientific, and everything was changing and moving and developing so fast. Like we had thought things that had never been thought before. Probably not. Probably they had been thought, maybe in different ways. But, like, we are not all that. You know, the 1990s and the development of kind of the postmodern deconstructionist theorists, like they were not the be-all, end-all. And they were thinking a lot of things that had been thought before. Exactly. Like, very much akin to the mystics. But... And I mean, that's just something that very much resonates with me. Like, my personal kind of reading and study in a university college setting was a real frustration with academics that had no connection to a spiritual life. Because for me, this is all meaningless without some sense of... spiritual, theological grounding of myself in something that I might call God.
And
you know,
the assumption that you have something called a self,
you know,
to ground.
That's deeply important to me, that as much as this is hugely important to me, this language of deconstruction is helpful to me in understanding myself and in understanding this world. I don't want it to just deconstruct to the point that there is no meaning, there is no ethic, there is no God, there is nothing that is worth anything, into a kind of nihilism, you know, that's like, no, that's not what I want. And that's not what I think this needs to get you to. I think that this is important for a process, you know, but not an end.
Yeah. So, I'm going to take Paul's point and ask Miriam, have we perhaps found a positive direction on reconstruction with something like gender through feminism? Does that offer us hope in finding reconstruction vis-a-vis sexuality?
Oh, on a road there. I guess I'm the first one to say, in terms of kind of the history of feminism, that, you know, all the people that say, like, feminism, yeah, we've done it, like, we're there, it's total bullshit. You know, like, we're still in the patriarchy. Like, we're still, like, as long as I look at who politically and economically has power in this country and in this world, and I see that pretty much all of them are men, I say, okay, we still don't have equity in this world. Like, we still don't even have close to equity. But we are in an amazing process that allows me to have the self-understanding that I do, that, you know, my mother had to fight for when she was my age. Like, you know, that nobody told, you know, my mother was told that basically, you know, she had a couple of choices in life, you know, to be a teacher, or to, you know, that she couldn't, you know, why should she study theology or religion? Because she was a woman. Why should she do that? Nobody told me that. And so that's 30 years difference there. And I think that there has been an amazing kind of reconstruction of what it means to be a woman, and interestingly enough, because there are women and men, a reconstruction of what it means to be a man in this culture, like, and a good reconstruction that has allowed men to be more than they were allowed. I think maybe that's, like, it's a wonderful thing that you say. I think that no, the world has not dissolved and fallen apart for those categories to have been broken open and reconstructed in a way where it is now pretty much socially acceptable in most of the United States for a girl, you know, a girl at the age of 5 or at the age of 10 to say, gosh, I want to be this or this or this, to imagine herself as many different things, and to feel that she has the power of decision to create herself in a lot of different ways. And that boys can do that similarly, that girls and boys can both play similar and different games, you know, all of these things, and that men and women can have these different roles in society, more and more varied roles than they were allowed, say, 30, 50, certainly 100 years ago. And I would like to think that people would not be so afraid of a deconstruction and reconstruction of sexuality, and I think it is hugely about fear. We are so tied to sex and fear and sexuality are so, like, and for important reasons, because sex is powerful and sexuality is powerful, and there's a good reason that we should have some fear around that, because there's so much in it. It's not something to toy with. It's not something to toy with lightly most of the time. So I understand the fear around that. What I would love to think of is our society being open enough to think that a reconstruction that allows more definition would not think that, you know, everything would fall apart then.
And I think we are seeing that. Sexual ethics is a good example to use because of its power. But, you know, like right after the last presidential election, and we kept seeing in magazines and on TV the blue and red areas of who went Democratic and who went Republican, and to just think of that as an image of what is sometimes called the culture war. But the older sexual ethic, which is still important in many places, was about the normativeness of heterosexuality, certain defining, and the normativeness of marriage, whether or not it was really followed, premarital sex, those rules. Now
in a large segment, maybe half of the U.S. population, we've seen over the last 20 years, 30 years, a dismantling of that and a reconstruction of something else, so that in this, whichever color that was, other side, other path, gay and lesbian isn't the long thing anymore, but there is a new ethic emerging that we're all becoming more and more aware of that defines sexual ethics in terms of power relations, not in terms of gender per se, but in terms of power relations, be that through gender, be that in workplace, be that in age, differentiation. When we are emerging into a new sexual ethic that is different, but it's still an ethic that's defining things. It's cutting things in a different way, and it's probably a way that's probably happening because it works for our historical moment. All these factors, the integrity not only of ourselves but of our historical epic, we need those changes sometimes. But that would be a place of where there's a, we can see, we may not have reached consensus yet, but we can see a new epic, a new reconstruction emerging.
Even as the integrity.
It would seem to me that the modern, what you're calling the modern philosophy or ethos or whatever, has a kind of prescribed role for what's being responsible, how to be a responsible person. And with the deconstruction that comes with postmodernism, the role of responsibility yet ill-defined.
What do I owe my neighbor?
Pardon?
What do I owe my neighbor?
You know, what's the good of the, how do you respond to the good of the order? Or do you think about the good of the order? And that in the terrorist backlash, it seems to me it's probably as much fueled by the fear of the postmodern deconstruction, and there's a terrible conservative backlash against that. And the question is, how to get to some sort of responsible, what ground do you stand on to define how to be responsible to each other, to the culture, to the society, to families, to
just like
we probably all feel like Trace
Fine. The whole notion of some people, yes, have certainly written about the collision of not even modern cultures, but pre-modern cultures, which they certain extremely traditional Islamic societies are. Terribly bad. I was in the Peace Corps, actually, in a country that was experiencing this very change, that of an ancient way of life based on solidities, based on a very definite notion of what one's social place was, with regard to family, the clan, the village, what your role was, what you did. And then, on the other hand, Procter & Gamble was moving in. You know, so there was, I think, on some level, people are right to view this conflict, whatever you view this conflict as a collision of a very, I would say, a virulent form of the postmodern world, which is sort of complete lack of, take a corporation as an individual with very little sense of personal or social responsibility, if that makes sense. You know, what is the role of the corporation in the world society. It owes nothing to anyone other than to its shareholders. And that, when that...
Not even that listing.
Not even that listing, really. And it would seem very much to me as if a number of the conflicts, not all, I'm never a fan of unified theories of everything, however attractive they may be, but I think many of the conflicts in our world are very much examples of what we call globalization on some level. I think is essentially a postmodern business ethic. It does not have much respect for place, for locale, for what we would regard as the solidity of culture in a certain way. It goes where profit drives it, and that often comes in conflict with and then denigrates many cultures that hold on to notions of, so rightly or wrongly, who knows, you know, I'm not defending a conservative patriarchal culture's right, if you will, to hold on to raping women as a form of punishment of a man who raped her. I mean, they're hot. I know, I've been reading the papers lately in Pakistan, and not all over. But anyway, the point being, I'm not arguing for either modernist or pre-modernist solidities in those cultures, but I would agree that I think you can very much use these conflicts. You can read them thus. You can read them with those tools of, you know, my postmodern lens and see what's going on. I don't know, actually. I think on some level, ethics, this is a little out of my realm, more into, yeah, I wanted to put that to you, that I think on some level, for me, I do come back very much to, call me a Christian, to Jesus, and you know, who is my neighbor? What do I owe them? Why do I take part in the social contract which says that I do this, I am this? I think there's still valid reasons for doing that, even after one has allowed some of the degree, if you will, of more oppressive aspects of modernist culture to go away.
I feel like, I mean, it's interesting, as much as this deconstructionist process has been helpful to me and interesting to me, I am personally deeply, almost like Augustinian, in my understanding of humanity. Like, I feel like human beings, I have this deep understanding, human beings are not goodness and light, you know, to start out with. We never have been, we never will be. And that there never has been an age where all was well. However society was constructed, people are broken, and there is a lot of pain. And we sometimes don't mean it, but we cause each other a lot of pain. And then there's repercussions. And in all the different ages of the development and shifts of our world, that human pain has manifested itself in different ways. So I guess the one thing that I am conscious of, or I like to kind of call into question, is to say that any one way of looking at, any one way of defining society or constructing society is going to create good, or create more good, or you know, is inherently bad in itself. I feel like human beings, and maybe that's actually a deeply modernist notion in me, to say that, you know, modernist or Christian or you know, Platonic almost, like a sense that there is some sort of unity across humanity through the centuries. Like, I think I believe that really deeply, and there are people that don't. I still do. It helps me understand. There is an inherently a sense of humanness for me. Well, then I feel like, well, gosh, a few hundred years ago, it was maybe people were oppressed in a smaller sense in their families or the sense of that as a woman I couldn't do this, or that there was nothing I could do if I was I was hurt by my parents or my father or my husband, that I had no power. Maybe now that's a very different, I have a very different situation, but there's still people, institutions, ways in which I will be hurt and oppressed. And similarly, whether it was 1,000 years ago or 300 years ago or now, I, as a person, have the responsibility to my fellow human beings, because I can cause and will cause and do cause other people pain, whether I do that involuntarily or intentionally sometimes. Hopefully not intentionally, but I know that happens, and I know that we all do that. I don't know if this is all making sense, but what I'm trying to say is I feel like it's not going to be deconstructionism, it's not going to be postmodernism as a way of looking at the world or a way of functioning that's going to destroy us. Like, human beings are going to do that regardless. And hopefully this as a system to understand ourselves and kind of re-understand ourselves can be as much helpful as it is harmful, at least. Maybe more helpful.
I want to respond to your comment as well. But I cut it a little differently than my two esteemed colleagues. I think to go back to your solid example, what the Islamic world objects to is Western modernism, and that postmodernism is the beginning of a hope that responsibility can be redefined in a way that's much more positive. Oftentimes, when I hear I'm also a Christian, I'll say that oftentimes when I hear social critics condemning Christianity, I think it's misplaced, and what they need to be critiquing is modernism and the unholy alliance that Protestantism, basically, but then it brought everybody else along with made with modernism, where what modernism took us out of a relationship with nature and made nature simply a resource that and not an environment. And we're in the situation we're in ecologically because of modern sensibilities, because of modernism. Modernism desacralized Western civilization. What Islam finds so disgusting about us is that we don't have any sacred center. We aren't an integrated culture. There's no holiness. At the time of the rise of modernism, Protestantism rose as a compromised way of desacramentalizing reality and doing a lot of head tripping and doing it only on Sundays, and that allowed it to continue existing. But for the most part, that isn't working anymore either. And there aren't many people. I mean, if Newsweek calls up on the phone in their latest opinion poll, they'll probably say, yeah, I believe in God. But there's nothing in our daily lives that looks like we believe in God.
the responsibilities of the responsibilities we have toward family and toward neighbor has pretty much broken down. The way we're raising our children is really sick. They're starting to act out in murderous ways. And part of what postmodernism is groping toward is this doesn't work. And what is that ground, as Mark and Marion talked about before? You know, is there spirituality? I mean, when our Christianity was mutated to allow industrial revolution to happen, what we got increasingly and are living in now is Christianity without God. So you have stewardship in the traditional Christian sense is certainly better than dominion without responsibility. I mean, that's what we have now. I don't think our corporate boards talk about their stewardship responsibilities or dedicate their decisions to God in prayer or, you know, all of that is modernism, and it's going to destroy the world. And we took away, not only did we take away the sacramentality of life, but we started taking away relationship and replacing it with something called social science, which kind of emerged in the 1890s. So. You know, we don't have to relate to each other anymore. We certainly don't go to confession, but we scientifically approach something we invented called psychology, and then over here we have sociology, and over here we have anthropology, and we're all experts, and it's all splitting apart, and that splitting apart is modernism because it allows us to exploit nature and each other for profit. And the church has tried to survive by allowing itself to be in a smaller and smaller and smaller box. And what we're seeing is such a need in Western people that we have something called New Age, which has emerged out of the soul of people because there's a need for spirituality, and the church isn't supplying it anymore, sadly. So that we get, and wouldn't you know that there's now a movement beyond postmodernism, who's represented by this guy, another French person, René Girard. He would look at postmodernism as being a real split, that it's both, it's just two sides of the same thing. But this is an interesting book that I'm sure, I know the three of us would be happy to sit here with anyone who wants to keep talking, but I want you to be able to leave without feeling rude. Modernism must be defined as the almost universal illusion that society is everything and that religion ultimately boils down to political and social questions. And how many of our liberal churches is this? You know, do we have prayer groups? Do we talk about the soul anymore? Or is what our church is about, are they, do we have spiritual directors like Ellen? Or do we have political and social ministries, which are important, but this whole thing, there's no ministry anymore, everything is society. That's modern. And to a certain extent, postmodernism is still there. It's redefining, he would say, I don't know if he's right, but it's redefining this, but that illusion that everything is social might be still at work. And maybe now there's, you know, if you burst open this enough, if we deconstruct this enough, what we're going to find is God. Maybe, I don't know, but that's a hope.
That there is a there.
There is.
As a...
And it's not just science. And it's
right.
not just, you know...
And empirical understanding.
And an empirical understanding that we can get through thinking about it all.
Outside ourselves. Anyway, you're willing to stay and talk more, I think. So if you want to stay, great. If you want to leave, you have to blast. Another question?
No, I'm just going to make a comment, man. That is, you've encouraged me, and that for a very long time I have felt that one of the most important elements that we could incorporate in worship, whether it's preaching or liturgy or what, is mystery. And that when there is little mystery left, there's little worship going on. And so the idea that there's something there that we can't talk about or define does not necessarily mean it's lost or inappropriate or whatever. It's the right thing. Maybe that's, you know, that's where God comes most real.
And you realize that one comes to realize, hopefully, maybe, that language, while always ultimately inadequate to the ultimate task of circling this thing, of describing the mystery, it's the tool we have. It, one of the tools, there are many, but it's a tool we have, and it points, whether liturgically, you know, it points, it evokes, it helps to create a space in our hearts, in our heads, in our beings, in our corporate gathering, where it, whatever the it is, the it beyond the language, is perceived, and yeah, one very much does enter mysticism there, but at least for me, it's a healthier sense of what the mystical is, what mystery is, more so than, say, how the word mystery operates in a modernist sense, which is, mystery is that which science has not yet explained, if that makes sense. Hopefully, we can look at that notion of mystery and say, well, please, that's just a matter of, you know, the usual derogatory notion of high church sensibilities, smells and bells. You know, oh, it's, you know, it's just obscuring the truth. And if you can get rid of that, the truth will still be there. Well, maybe. But at least a notion for me is where that it will always remain a mystery. And I guess that's a unity for me as well. As you were saying, you know, humanness. One can assume humanness throughout culture, throughout time. It's an assumption one is making, but humanness is something unifying. One, but, you know, call it an article, you know, article of faith, check number one, you know. Check number two, perhaps, for me, might be, there will be a mystery to what it means to be human. And to what it means to be human in a relationship is something called the divine. Whether those two circles, human and divine, merge, whether they are and there one enters the realm of theology again. But I think it's a different notion of mystery, not that which has not yet been explained yet, but that which will never be explained fully in language. And that's a good thing.
Is a language that it can't be explained in? I mean, it seems to me that if you take...
Or consciousness color.
What?
You use a consciousness color, perhaps. But that I apologize.
Well, if you take...
responsibility, responsibility to life, love of life, mm-hmm. reverence for life, those things can't be explained scientifically. And I don't know that they can be deconstructed.
True, although one could, and I wouldn't argue with it, although one could say that there are certain people in our human cultures who have exhibited no love of life or respect for life. Like, I guess for me, I'm not sure that I'm, just for myself, that I could regard a love of life as inherently natural, if that makes sense.
Why does it have to be inherently natural?
Oh, I don't know, but I mean, that, at least that's what I hear.
I'm not hearing a question yet.
I don't know that I really
have
a question, but I certainly don't think those things are inherently natural.
Okay.
Oh.
I think they have to be worked at. I think they have to be thought about. I think language is an important way in which one gets to them. Mm-hmm.
But so for you, I guess I apologize. I was hearing you say that more as a something which we possess, kind of either from the get-go, from socialization, or not. And you seem to
think it was something that we could get to.
To get to, yes.
Mm-hmm. See, I would say that our society does not even allow us to begin to get to, because mm-hmm. responsibility is nil in this world. I mean, responsibility, the actual interconnection between beings, that shared love of life, doesn't it? We can all say in this room that we wouldn't want to kill someone, we wouldn't want to oppress someone. The true sad truth is that every day something happens as we are directly involved in which does that. And we can't connect to it, we don't see it, it doesn't affect us directly, so we can't approach it in any way. We can't say that we live responsibly, that we live in love and harmony with other people. If we can, the idea of the deconstruction of things is, I think, the attempt to get to a place where we can be closer to one another. So if I do something, it immediately affects someone else. I have a vision of that. I can see that. It comes back to me in some way directly. Mm-hmm. The problem with that, and where the fear of building things back up, the reconstruction issue, where I think the fear comes in, is that people are afraid that the small percentage of humanity, which will ignore all those rules that can look at someone and shoot them in the head and not worry about it at all, will be what everyone will become. That nihilism will take over the world if you don't have a great responsibility, if you don't have a structure to imagine everything. And I personally would like to think that if you could break down all societal norms, societal structures, that you will be shown the results of your actions. And that being shown the results of your actions, the being forced to see that you harm people, will cause you to not harm people, will cause you to live in a more loving way. And that the fear is that everyone says that no, that won't happen. Nihilism is a great direction, and postmodernism is gone. Mm-hmm. Written about obsessively and taken off into branches, this whole ridiculous notion of, right. of not being able to move one's finger is just... That's just masturbation. It's nothing at all. I mean, it goes to the point of like ridicule. It's a fear of saying that there shouldn't be, that the social structures are the things that get us in trouble. Social structures are the things that put problems in our way, that take us apart from one another. And that, I mean, I think that's what the anarchists have been saying for a long time. And anarchists has always thought of as a way of destroying things. It's never a way of giving a chance for people to actually choose to not kill and choose to interact in positive ways.
Although one could say that you would only be able to see immediately the results of your actions if you lived, like, at least for me, this brings up another problem in our culture, is our incredibly mobile society, where we, I mean, that sense of responsibility raises the question, responsibility to whom? How do I identify my community so that I can know immediately
when I do this, oh, that hurts you. Oh,
that's
my.
What we try to do up here, though, isn't it? Sure. Not while we're going through this little environment, we try to make little communities where we can immediately see the impact of our actions on others.
Well, right. So, no, I'm not disagreeing with you, but I'm thinking of our culture as a whole and its incredible mobility. And I mean, just, you know, you're using transportation systems as a metaphor. Hopping in the car, going on the interstate, stop at the fast food restaurant, stop at the gas, and so on. These don't seem like harmful or violent things to do. But, you know, think how long the gas had to travel to get to that gas station, the hamburger to get to that one. Think about the person, people working at either of those places being paid with their lives are like, you know, and you're participating in this. And what is your responsibility to those people? What's the violence you are being part of in those things?
I don't think you have that. I don't think it's possible for us to have it in modern society. I think that that's where most of our problems come from, is that we can't begin to approach living responsibility in this world. It's impossible for Americans to begin to approach living responsibility.
But
you
so
can try at it. You can make little games at
right,
it.
Right, but
can,
so
like, pick little
a question
to go
might be, you know, do you all right? So you want to get rid of every social structure that there was, and with at least the notion beforehand of, you know, starting beforehand, which would be kind of the anarchists.
Well, primitivism,
right?
To that, which is, right. I mean, these are also one again another realm going off in a direction we can't actually ever happen. We're not going to just move. Mm-hmm. How do we do this besides the nuclear holocaust or something where it breaks everything down? So I mean, it's hard to go anywhere with a lot of this discussion, I guess, but I come back to you constantly. Except that in the little things is where you take benefit from it. You can say, so we have been moving towards breaking down the normal rules of society and rituals and making them have more choice in having those rules. But is that also an illusion? Yeah, it's possible.
But hopefully, ultimately, coming to that sense of responsibility, if you will, through that more clearly realized sense of how your actions do affect not just the other right here, but.
And re-understanding responsibility. I mean, I feel like, gosh, and, you know, in the 19th century, a lot of white, you know, Americans thought it was the responsible thing to, you know, conquer the United States and Christianize all of these various Native American tribes. And that was responsible. Because otherwise these people were going to hell, you know, or, you know, whatever. What are all of the layers of things that were happening there? But certainly that was the rhetoric, you know. So, sure, that was a lot of responsibility. The white man's burden of responsibility. My goodness, you had a lot of work to do in your little life, you know. But I mean, so then if we look at that as a way that a mere century ago, and really probably a lot more recently than that, that was how we, in the United States, culturally, as white people, understood responsibility. How do we have to shift that? How do we use that word with a more honestly? How do we open up that word and say, what does it really mean to be responsible? And I guess then I don't use the word responsibility that much, and I'm kind of intrigued by that word right now, just so I'm thinking, because I'm like, gosh, because there's a lot of weight in it. And you do have to define it really carefully. And I do think a lot of, in perhaps a very, you know, of my generation sort of way, like, connections and relationships, and, you know, it's all language, you know, it's all the language of the age, whatever, but yeah, what are those connections that I need to make? And I do believe very strongly in affecting other people. You know, I don't believe that I don't have an effect on someone else, but mm-hmm. How do I make that effect a good thing? And I do believe that there is good you know, that there is a good thing to be made of an effect. You know, it's not just an
effect that you can simply deconstruct.
Yeah, you know, no. There is a good effect, and there's also a bad effect. You know, I can misuse people. So how do I not do that?
And we've gone through a huge shift that kind of which feminism is a part, but when we're talking about our responsibility to the social order, that's a great chain of words to deconstruct and say, well, what do we mean by responsibility? What do we mean by social order? And a big thing that's happened over the past 50 years is hearing voices that had hitherto been silenced for the sake of the social order. And, you know, the white man's burden was not just in terms of people of color, but also women. You know, they had the responsibility of taking care of women, and women were silent in terms of how they wanted to be taken care of or if they did. So we have we're reconstructing a social order in which gay people and black people and Native Americans and women are all getting voices and able to say, we want responsibility and we want to reshape the social order in this way. And that can feel, depending on your personal location and the social order, that might feel threatening or like wrong. But it might also, but for other people at different positions in the social order, it might feel liberating and even like salvation.
And even for white men who can't otherwise lay claim to some victimized group. I'm serious. I think it's important to say that, because otherwise it becomes an exclusionary kind of tactic. It sounds like a bumper sticker, but everyone's a part of it. And I do believe that very much, but from a differently informed notion of what responsibility and social order might look like, might be.
This discussion of responsibility, it brings to mind a little piece that I read by Thomas Merton about one of the things that the Nuremberg trials brought out was that the leadership of within the Nazi regime, the men were totally sane. They were totally sane men. And I guess that Merton didn't go this far, but what it leads me to think about is modernism. And kind of like you're saying, the double edge, the good and the bad. And a part of that is the whole systemic evil that is allowed to exist within the context of modernism. And I think postmodernism, I'm hopeful that one of the things it's going to do is challenge those, the ability of systemic evil to propagate.
Mm. Right, because in a modernist notion, if you can't empirically prove that something is, you know, so why shouldn't we exterminate the Jews? You know, empirically prove to me why that is wrong. Can you? You can ethically do it.
They were very responsible.
They were very responsible.
They were extremely responsible.
Yes. Very responsible, very methodical, very,
yeah,
very scientific.
Yes, but from a very narrow and defined perspective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which obviously was the truth.
Certainly. But I say that the narrow perspective had nothing to do with their science or their responsibility or their sanity. Their narrowness had to do with something that exists in, I think, in another realm of human thought, which is ethics and what we call
morality, which I think we've tried to think of in very quantitative, empiricist, rationalist ways of thinking. The grand discipline of ethics in some Kant. It's a huge, this is the age of enlightenment.